From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Gospel According to Hollywood. Passover and Easter are coming up, so on this archive edition, we're featuring interviews with actors and directors about making Hollywood biblical epics. Charlton Heston remembers leading 8,000 extras across the Red Sea in the Ten Commandments. Elmer Bernstein tells us how he wrote the music that accompanied their exodus. Martin Scorsese shares his frustrations about the shortage of extras in The Last Temptation of Christ. Then Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis tell us about making the biblical era epic Spartacus. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, The Paper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has approved a new budget outline. It spends $1.5 trillion and reduces the deficit to a six-year low. The budget also requires $26 billion in cuts the White House opposes, but senators haven't decided where these cuts will come from. Both the House and Senate must reconcile their different budget bill versions. Defense Secretary William Perry says there is no military crisis on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea is still warning that pressure to admit weapons inspectors could trigger a war. Inspectors were unable to carry out a full nuclear weapons inspection recently. Perry told reporters today the United States will send more sophisticated weaponry to South Korea, but he says that is purely defensive. He also says the United Nations, or rather if the United Nations, authorizes sanctions against North Korea, the U.S. will want to increase its forces there.
If and when the United Nations decides to authorize sanctions, at that time, we will certainly want to increase the defensive measures in Korea, not because we believe that the sanctions are provocative, but because North Korea has stated that any level of sanctions would be provocative. That might just be rhetoric, but it is prudent on our part to take it seriously.
President Clinton has released his tax returns for his first years in public office. He's hoping to put to rest questions about his Whitewater investments. The papers show the Clintons had a substantial increase of income in 1979. They made thousands that year, mostly because of trading in commodities. New Jersey investigators are still searching for bodies in the rubble of eight Edison buildings that were destroyed when a gas pipeline exploded. New Jersey Governor Christine Whitman has declared a state of emergency. Gene Dillard reports from Trenton, New Jersey.
The emergency declaration includes an order requiring all natural gas suppliers with transmission lines in New Jersey to reduce the pipeline pressure by 5%. Governor Whitman says she's attempting to err on the side of caution until investigators determine for sure what caused the explosion.
I think we want to be extraordinarily careful that our residents can feel secure that if this did in fact come from a shift in the ground because of hot and cold, that we have taken every step that we can to minimize any further risk.
Whitman conceded tougher regulations may also be needed to require more frequent pipeline inspections. The line in which the explosion occurred had not been fully inspected since 1986. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
A real estate trade group says sales of existing homes dropped almost 10% last month. The National Association of Realtors says the decline of home resales was probably due to bad wintry weather. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials have fallen almost 40 points to 3,781. This is NPR. Investigators say the Amtrak derailment in Alabama last September that killed 47 people was not the result of any criminal wrongdoing. Mobile, Alabama prosecutor Chris Galanos says there was no criminal liability, but he says his report doesn't look at civil liability. Numerous lawsuits have been filed by the families of victims from the September 22nd accident. The report finds no state law was violated when barges pushed by a towboat crashed into a railroad bridge. The crash came just minutes before the Sunset Limited train ran off the span. The Coast Guard says the towboat pilot surrendered his license rather than face a Coast Guard hearing. The German government has strongly condemned an arson attack on a synagogue in northern Germany. It's offering a $30,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the attackers. NPR's Dietra Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Two Molotov cocktails were thrown overnight into the offices of the synagogue in Lubeck, destroying the rooms. Residents living in apartments over the synagogue could escape without injury. The synagogue cantor was awakened by the sound of breaking glass and alarmed authorities, who could put out the fire before it spread to nearby buildings. 27 Jews live in Lubeck, most recent immigrants from Russia. Investigation has been taken over by federal prosecutors, who suspect the attack is the work of right-wing extremists. The head of Germany's Jewish community, Ignaz Bubis, accused the government of not taking the danger of right-wing extremism seriously enough. Local residents have started a weekend-long vigil to protest the attack. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Military authorities say the death toll has risen to 22 from the military plane crash at Pope Air Force Base. President Clinton has flown to the base to express his sympathies. Two military planes collided at the base on Wednesday when both tried to land at the same time and collided into a third. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Lord, I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments for all to obey.
On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, as many people prepare for Easter and Passover, we salute Hollywood's biblical epics. Mel Brooks spoofed the biblical epic in his movie History of the World Part 1. Our first guest, Charlton Heston, starred in The Real Thing.
From the burning bush, O Lord, you charged me to bring the people to this holy mountain, to behold your glory and receive your law. What have I left undone?
Charlton Heston was Moses in The Ten Commandments, which is broadcast on TV nearly every year at about this time. His booming voice reverberated in other biblical spectacles like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. I spoke with Heston in 1990. In The Ten Commandments, you had to lead and to speak to a cast of thousands. Can you describe what went into one of those scenes, or one of the really large scenes where all the extras were?
Well, the Exodus is, I suppose, one of the largest scenes of that kind ever filmed.
Mm-hmm.
It had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took, to get the shots with all those people, you could only do about 5 takes a day, because you to get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur, any of those films again, because they're far, far too expensive. I saw they ran the Ben-Hur budget, the original budget, which turned up in somebody's file drawer, through a modern computer program that production managers use when they're budgeting films. To make Ben-Hur today would cost $127,800,000.
Wow. So tell me something about what it was like to do the Exodus scene and the crossing the Red Sea scene with...
Well, you need the stick. You have to have the stick to do it. Did you
of
notice
course.
What a nice day it was in New York yesterday? You're welcome. I'm glad to do it. Glad to help. But obviously those scenes are, in a sense, the English actors call NAR, no acting required. If you stand in front of 8,000 people in the Egyptian desert and lift up a stick and say, "Bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings," you don't need to act that. The scene does it for you. You are overwhelmed by the reality of what is around you.
Yeah, it must give you a real sense of power.
Indeed it does.
Even though it's all stage, you've still got, 8,000 people following
yes,
you.
Yes, it's quite an awesome experience.
Mm-hmm. Your infant son ended up playing the baby Moses in The Bulrushes.
He began playing. He ended up a writer-director. I just finished working for him.
Oh, right. Right.
So he began.
That was
the beginning and end of his acting career.
Right.
I think he realized the shortcomings of a career in front of the camera and quickly switched behind.
Well, how did your baby end up getting the part?
I mean, the striking resemblance kind of didn't
I don't think a resemblance was a factor.
Yeah.
My wife, who was then an actress herself, was unable to go to Egypt on the location because she was carrying our then unborn son. And DeMille was obviously aware of this, and he said, "When is the baby due?" And she said, "In February." And he said, "That means that he will be 3 months old, if it's a boy, when we get to the shots of the infant Moses in the bulrushes." And he said, "If it's a boy, he can play the part." And at about an hour and a half after Fraser was born, which was 3 o'clock in the morning, she got a telegram from DeMille in the hospital. It said, "Congratulations, he's got the part."
I thought you were going to say, "Congratulations, it's a Moses."
No.
You did the voice of God, right? In the scene where Moses is on the mountain and God is telling the Ten Commandments.
Well, which I think is perfectly logical, because where do we hear the voice of God? Inside our own heads, right? And whose voice speaks inside your head?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is... Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot racing has always been considered one of the really important action sequences.
Category for chariot races, though.
You're right. So you had to...
It is regarded, I suppose, as the best action sequence ever filmed, but it was not... It didn't win an award.
You had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture, I was a minimally competent charioteer. But as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, "You know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now, but there's just the one team out here. And when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams, and I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not." And he looked at me and he said, "Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race." As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way
indeed,
real quick?
All of them. Mm-hmm. Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks' work in the chariot. But he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm. There are all these scenes where...
action sequence, mm-hmm. if the principal has been trained to do whatever it is he's supposed to do well enough to be photographed doing it, you are surrounded by professionals. I mean, they were not about to run over me if I fell out of the chariot. I don't think they were.
And it didn't really run over Stephen Boyd when he fell out, right?
No. No. What was an accident was I drove a great deal of the sequences, mm-hmm. but the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck...
Yeah.
Was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out and I didn't do that. Joe Kanat, Yak's son, but Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him, because those things weighed 0.5 ton with steel wheels. But then Weiler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, "We got to use that shot." And Jack said, "I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot?" And Willie said, "Well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in," which I did very quickly.
Charlton Heston, recorded in 1990. The Jews in the film The Ten Commandments marched out of bondage to a stirring score by Elmer Bernstein.
Elmer Bernstein is one of the most highly regarded composers working in film. He also wrote the music for The Man with the Golden Arm, Some Came Running, Walk on the Wild Side, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Magnificent Seven, Ghostbusters, Airplane, and The Age of Innocence. In 1991, Bernstein told me about the music that director Cecil B. DeMille asked him to write for The Ten Commandments.
The music for the film was basically, the concept of the music was Wagnerian, because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical cliches?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. well, necessarily so. I mean, you know, I tell you who tried to break that, as a matter of fact, was once again Marty Scorsese and The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, sure.
In which he used Peter Gabriel doing a lot of electronic music. I think, you know, it was very interesting about that. When we finished The Ten Commandments, the music of The Ten Commandments, and I'd gotten to the point of that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, "Mr. DeMille, sir," and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, "Wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ?" He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross, at the same, sort of in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politics, so to speak. And DeMille said, "You know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore in the atmosphere which exists in the world today." Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the cliches, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, like what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age. And I think indeed it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway... Where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who plays shofars, of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday, and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals. There were about 8,000 people. And they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it. He hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble. It looks like the picture. And the picture is too slow. He said, now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that is... accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now, but it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical because eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
Elmer Bernstein recorded in 1991. Martin Scorsese on The Last Temptation of Christ after this break. This is Fresh Air. Martin Scorsese reworked the biblical epic genre when he directed The Last Temptation of Christ, with Willem Dafoe as Christ. When Scorsese spoke at New York University last year, he described the frustrations of filming an epic when your budget is only $7 million and you're shooting on location in North Africa.
I'll never forget the surrounding of the temple. I had five guys from Rome, five stuntmen. And they had Roman costumes on, Roman soldier costumes, right? And I had to, there was a trouble in the temple, whatever, and they look up, they hear a sound, they look up, and Roman soldiers come up, and then Roman soldiers come up, more Roman soldiers, and more over here. Well, I had five guys. Wow. The trick was to learn, again, go back, the whole picture was storyboarded because we had no time for anything. We had no time to breathe. To get there, and by the time we got to the location too, this was out in the desert in places, you know. And so I realized it was the old, you know, I drew the shots and I figured, okay, I know what I have to do. But when I was doing it, I was just, oh, it was so painful. But I said, all right, this is it. Five of them come up here, flash pan, cut, same five guys. That's it. And then they had to fight the Levite guards. And they became the Levite guards on reverses. I'm not kidding. And I said, I can't believe what we're doing. I said, if I hadn't studied Roger Corman pictures, you would never be able to do this. But I mean, they were the same, the Levite guards. I couldn't believe it. I said, for the reverse, now we got, and they were all yelling in Italian and it was the most despairing moment. And I had just read the reviews for Empire of the Sun and The Last Emperor from they sent Time magazine. I said, oh, beautiful, we got to see the film. But look, they had, oh, look at all the extras he had. Oh, what have I done? I said, maybe I was just too eager to do it. Maybe I should have waited. And Michael Ball, I said, Marty, they're never going to give you that kind of extra for this picture. Let's shoot. Come on, get up. Come on, let's go. And it was hysterical. If you look at the temple scene, every shot, the same guys. Every now and then we change a helmet.
Martin Scorsese recorded last year at NYU. Back in 1987, our linguist Jeff Nunberg did a piece for us on accents in the movies. Today, actors take pride in perfecting accents that are true to the region and the historical period. But Hollywood used to be inconsistent about this sort of thing. Accents depended on whether you were in a drama, romance, adventure, or biblical epic.
Hollywood didn't used to care much about the authenticity of movie accents. Claude Rains talked the same way whether he was playing an English rake, a French policeman, or a senator from Montana. And nobody seemed to mind that Clark Gable played Fletcher Christian in Mutiny on the Bounty with vowels that could only have been shaped in Ohio and with never a word of explanation. Yet, curiously, casting directors did used to pay attention to accents in certain films, and precisely those in which accents should have been entirely irrelevant. Take the ancient Roman costume epics that flourished until the 1950s, Quo Vadis, Spartacus, The Robe, and so forth. There were strict linguistic conventions in these films, which, needless to say, had nothing to do with the Latin or Hebrew of the period. The Roman patricians had to be played by British actors like Peter Ustinov or Laurence Olivier. The heroes, Christians, slaves, gladiators, depending on the film, the heroes were played by Americans like Kirk Douglas or Charlton Heston. And in the roles of apostles, you had to have Jews or Irishmen, almost always either Sam Jaffe or Finlay Curry. This casting was crucial to the key scene in all these movies, when a Roman patrician, say, was interrogating a young Christian girl. The captain has these impeccable West End vowels, and he says something like, "This Nazarene you speak of, how many legions has he?" And the Christian girl answers, 12, my lord." 12 legions? Why have I not heard of them?" 12 men, my lord." 12 men? Why, what are 12 men against all that is Rome?" Of course, sometimes box office realities intruded in the casting process. But in these films, unlike Mutiny on the Bounty, say, you had to put something in the script that would explain away the oddity. In Spartacus, for example, Jean Simmons was cast as a Christian. Her British accent was explained by making her a British slave. Never mind that the British in those days were wild tribesmen who liked to paint themselves blue and dance around the local henge. You weren't supposed to inquire too deeply into these things. In fact, these movies used accents to explain the difference between Christians and Romans, which, as it happens, was just like the difference between Americans and Europeans. As the American poet Randall Jarrell put it, "They are smarter than we, and we are better than they. Their sophistication has, unfortunately, made them bad, just as our naivete has, fortunately, kept us good." Nowadays, of course, movie accents in general are supposed to be naturalistic. When they remade Mutiny on the Bounty in 1962, Marlon Brando was required to play Fletcher Christian with a British accent, which he apparently produced by knitting his eyebrows together until his adenoids screamed in pain. And by way of revenge, we've had to listen to actors like Lawrence Harvey and Albert Finney giving us their versions of American speech. But curiously, the linguistic conventions of fantasy have survived. True, the evil empires of recent movies are operating out of Death Stars rather than the Seven Hills of Rome. Yet even in far-off galaxies, evidently, the Force tends to favor those who pronounce their R's.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist affiliated with Stanford University. He often contributes to our program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on epics in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, I'm Spartacus. Actor Kirk Douglas was the leader of the slave rebellion in the Roman epic Spartacus, and Tony Curtis was one of the slaves. The film was restored a couple of years ago to include a previously censored scene between Curtis and Laurence Olivier, who played his master. Douglas and Curtis will tell us about making the movie. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, The Paper, starring Michael Keaton, Glenn Close, Robert Duvall, and Randy Quaid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate is considering a $12 billion education bill. North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms is trying to block it. He blocked consideration of the measure for 6 hours earlier this week because of his concern about school prayer. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senator Helms tried to stop the bill because representatives of the House and Senate have agreed to a compromise measure that doesn't include his school prayer amendment. The amendment, which was not part of the original House bill, would have barred any school aid to any state that prevented constitutionally protected school prayer in public schools by individuals on a voluntary basis. The conference committee instead prohibited the use of money for anti-prayer policies. Senator Helms was shown that language and didn't disagree, nor did Republican negotiators. But when the bill came to the floor this week for final passage, Helms blocked it with a six-hour reading of President Clinton's budget address and then the 213-page education bill itself. The delay put off the vote until Saturday, or 1 minute after midnight tonight. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Clinton administration is proposing new rules that would ban smoking in as many as 6 million public workplaces. The Labor Department is also proposing other rules that would improve indoor air quality. Smoking is also being considered in the House, where a panel is debating if the government should regulate nicotine as a drug. The Food and Drug Administration is also considering it. Street battles erupted today in Paris as tens of thousands of students protested nationwide. They're demonstrating against a new law that reduces the minimum wage for graduates. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
At least 20,000 students turned up for the march in Paris. It started peacefully, but it wasn't long before several hundred young people broke away from the crowd and started throwing bottles and stones at police. The clashes intensified at the end of the march when police tried to break it up. This violence reflects the growing desperation among young people in France about the future. They're worried about AIDS, poverty, and unemployment. The new law allows companies to hire people under 25 on training contracts and pay them salaries 20% less than the minimum wage, which is about $1,000 a month. The protesters say the law undermines their diplomas and won't ensure them of getting a permanent job. They say they'll continue protesting until the government rescinds the law. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The last American troops in Somalia are gone. The final amphibious vehicle left the beach today loaded with Marines. One spokesman says the Marines have accomplished their mission. A military spokesman for the UN forces still in Somalia says UN officials are apprehensive. On Wall Street, stock prices closed sharply lower for the second day in a row. The Dow dropped 46 points to end at 3,775. This is NPR. The Israeli army has sent troops into the occupied territories. Police throughout the country are on high alert. The government is taking precautions because there have been warnings that Arab terrorists could carry out vengeance attacks during Passover. There's been unrest in Gaza. Soldiers shot and wounded two Palestinians when a group of stone throwers attacked a group of soldiers on patrol. Muslim worshippers in Hebron were prevented by Israeli soldiers from entering mosques today. The military has not said why it did that. The prospects for enlarging the European Union by the end of the year appear bleaker today, as an internal dispute between current EU members shows no signs of being resolved. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Britain and Spain continue to argue with their 10 other European Union partners over the right to veto legislation passed by the EU. The two nations fear their veto rights will be diluted if four new countries, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Austria, join the Union as planned. In an interview with the Guardian newspaper, British Prime Minister John Major now says he's willing to see enlargement postponed before he'll give in, despite the fact that all EU nations are eager to see the four wealthy countries join the Union. The ongoing dispute is beginning to cause concern among the four applicants, who must convince their skeptical populations that the Union is worth joining. This latest round of infighting may make that job harder, especially in Scandinavia, where polls already show a large percentage of voters opposed to EU membership. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
Authorities think rain in Edison, New Jersey, could help investigators at a demolished apartment complex. It was destroyed when a natural gas pipeline blew up. The investigators hope the rain will wash away ash that's covering debris at the site. It could also help search teams that are using dogs to sniff for bodies. They've made at least three sweeps of the area and are doing more today. Eight buildings were leveled yesterday when the pipeline blew up. Only one person has died. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Our archive edition today features actors and directors who have made biblical-era epics.
Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
Kirk Douglas ended up on the cross in the 1960 epic Spartacus. He starred as the leader of a slave rebellion in ancient Rome. Spartacus is one of the biggest of the big historical spectacles, with big stars, Kirk Douglas, Tony Curtis, Charles Laughton, Laurence Olivier, and a cast of thousands. The battle scenes required 5,000 uniforms and 7 tons of custom-made armor. Spartacus even had an epic running time, about 3 hours. I spoke to Kirk Douglas in 1988. He didn't just star in Spartacus, he produced it. In his autobiography, he wrote that after starring in The Vikings, he didn't want to be in another epic. So I asked him why he made Spartacus.
I didn't want to make an epic, and one of the first things I said to my group, I said, look, if we do this picture Spartacus, let's make it as if it were a small picture. And to me, if you look at Spartacus again, you will find that the characters dominate the background. Most pictures, Ben-Hur and all that, the background is so enormous. But in Spartacus, Olivier, Laughton, Ustinov, Gene Simmons, the characters are stronger than the background. And that's what I try to do. In spite of the fact that it was an epic picture, I wanted the characters to be, for them to be larger than life.
You mentioned the characters and some of the actors. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British, and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie, and I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple, for example, when I did the Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech, so that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great, great stage actors. Great British
right.
stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian. You, Jewish. Tony Curtis, Italian. No, Tony Curtis is Jewish too, actually, isn't
that's
he?
That's right.
That's right. I always forget that.
But it doesn't matter. You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played when it's done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended it.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and the Romans have the more genteel, educated, refined sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Was this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do? Do you think it's pretty standard in epics of that period to cast that way?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just,
okay,
my way of looking at the picture.
Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
Can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators. There's never been an army like that. One gladiator's worth any two Roman soldiers that ever lived.
We beat the Roman guards here, but a Roman army's a different thing. They fight different than we do, too.
We can beat anything they send against us if we really want to.
It takes a big army for that, Spartacus.
We'll have a big army. Once we're on the march, we'll free every slave in every town and village. Can anybody get a bigger army than that?
That's right. Once we cross the Alps, we're safe.
Nobody can cross the Alps. Every pass is defended by its own legion.
There's only one way to get out of this country. The sea.
What good is the sea if you have no ships?
The Cilician pirates have ships. They're at war with Rome. Every Roman galley that sails out of Brundusium pays tribute to them.
They've got the biggest fleet in the world. I was a galley slave with them. Give them enough gold and they'll take you anywhere.
We haven't got enough gold. Take every Roman we capture and warm his back a little. We'll have gold all right.
Spartacus is right. Let's hire these pirates and march straight to Brundusium.
Well, they get their army and you as Spartacus lead them against the Roman army. I think the battle scene in Spartacus where the slave army and the Roman army fight is one of the most interestingly choreographed movie battle scenes. The slaves are massed in almost a checkerboard formation. There are people in the slave and the Roman army as far as you can see. It is this huge vista of people. And I'm wondering what your most vivid memory of being in the middle of all of that is.
Well, you see, all of that was historically accurate. We studied how Romans fought, you know, and how they arranged their armies. And, of course, that was a scene. We shot the entire picture in the United States, except for those scenes, which we shot in Spain, because you needed so many people, and we used lots of Spanish soldiers. The battle scenes were all shot in Spain because it needed thousands of people.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. The body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Kirk Douglas recorded in 1988. Tony Curtis on his censored scene from Spartacus after this break. This is Fresh Air. A restored version of Spartacus was released in 1991. It included a previously censored scene featuring Tony Curtis and Laurence Olivier. In a 1991 interview, Tony Curtis told me about making that scene. Laurence Olivier played the head of the Roman army. Tony Curtis played Olivier's sensitive slave boy who joins the slave uprising and becomes like a son to Spartacus.
In this scene, Curtis is attending to Olivier in the bath. Curtis gives his master a robe, then Olivier talks about the splendor of Rome.
There, boy, is Rome. The might, the majesty, the terror of Rome. There is the power that bestrides the known world like a colossus. No man can withstand Rome. No nation can withstand her. How much less a boy? There's only one way to deal with Rome, Antoninus. You must serve her. You must abase yourself before her. You must grovel at her feet. You must love her. Isn't that so, Antoninus?
Well, you get the point there. Olivier is suggesting that Curtis should not only give in to the power of Rome, but to the sexual power of his master.
It's very metaphoric. The whole thing is so...
Well, he doesn't come out and say, I want to stick it to you, dear. I mean, you know, he talks about snails and oysters. It's a clever way of... Or they think it's an artistic way of doing it. I would have much preferred the scene were a little more blatant in its approach because it would have been a lot more logical and perhaps a lot more realistic. But somebody thought it would be kind of fanciful to talk of fish. I really don't know why.
Well, I actually have the script from that scene in front of me, so let me read some of it. I won't pretend like I'm you or Olivier.
Well, please.
But Crassus, played by Olivier, asks you a bunch of questions. He asks you, do you steal, Antoninus? And you say, no, master. And he says, do you lie? And you say, no, master. And he says, have you ever dishonored the gods? And you say, no. He says, do you refrain from these vices out of respect for the moral virtues? And you say, yes. Then he asks you if you eat oysters and if you eat snails. And you say that you eat oysters, but you don't eat snails. And he asks you if you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral and so on. And then he confesses that he eats both.
Yes.
It's kind of like swinging both ways type subtext here. So did you and Olivier really talk through the scene before you did it? You
know, absolutely not. There's nothing to talk through. There I am in a bikini.
Yeah, you're wearing your bathing trunks.
Standing over him while he sits in a bikini in a tub. I mean, it doesn't really take a lot of internal dialogue to describe or even know what's going on.
Was there a big fight with the censors over the scene?
No, there wasn't. I don't think the studio had any plans to really put it in, you know?
Well, whose idea was it to put it in?
Well, it had to go in. Larry, Olivier, and I wouldn't have done the other scenes had not that scene been shot. See, it was written in the script, and before the picture was made, they decided that it's not going to end up in the movie. So we shot that scene, but only on the protest. Larry and I told the production department and the producer of the film that we would not be interested in doing the second scene unless we had that first scene. And we wouldn't do that first scene unless we had the scene before it where he sees me in a lineup and says to me, your name? You will attend to me. All of those were implicit in this kind of string of the relationship between Crassus and Antoninus. That's what you call complete movie making. It was very important. And for them to cut that scene out hurt that whole center of the film, and I feel it hurt the movie completely because it kind of, you know, washed it down to nothing, so you weren't quite sure what that meant.
So did either of you take the lead in objecting to the scene being cut or in insisting that
no, we both,
the scene be
we
played?
Both knew what the relationship between Crassus and Antoninus was, and we both insisted that the scenes had to be done the way the script was written. So we got them to shoot that scene, but they never recorded the sound. You know, they discarded the sound because they knew that it would probably never be in the film. Larry and I hoped it would be, and when we saw the final cut and realized they had cut it, we knew that, it was hurting the performances, but there was nothing we could do about it. And here we are 30-some-odd years later, and it's back in the movie. And I'm sure if Larry were alive, he'd really be happy to know that.
Now, the scene that we're talking about had no sound. So that means that you had a dub in the sound when they decided to restore it.
Yes.
And Olivier is no longer with us. How did you...
Well, I did Olivier, and they got somebody else to do me.
Right.
They got Anthony Hopkins to do Olivier.
Uh-huh. But you, even for you doing yourself, I mean, it wasn't anybody standing in for you, but still a voice changes in...
Well, all you do is kick it up a little bit higher.
Is that what you did?
Well, that's what I did. I'm doing it now.
Does it sound convincing?
Well, it's convincing to me.
Do you remember any of the logistical problems in the big battle scene?
Yes, there was a scene that was shot in Death Valley, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember now the exact location, where down in the valley were thousands of soldiers and men lined up, and the camera panned up and came up a hill. And as it came up a hill, it disclosed, I think, Spartacus on the horse. And just as that camera came there, the horse bolted and took Kirk off in a big steam of sand and dirt, and was never seen again in that shot. So we had to go do it again. It was a complicated scene, and that horse just would not, you know, pay attention to it. Because after all of the action, the camera would slowly pan and disclose that horse. So it had those kind of problems, you know. Charlie McGraw, an actor who was doing a scene with Kirk Douglas, and he was the, what would you call it, the guy that ran the gladiator school. He and Spartacus, when they revolt, had a fight. And in the struggle, Kirk pushed his head, Charles McGraw's head, onto the edge of the barrel and split his eye open. You can see it in the movie, just blood gushing out. So that held up the shooting for a long time.
Oh, you mean he really hurt him
Yes.
accidentally?
So there were always accidents like that. I had hurt my tendon on the film, and at one point I just couldn't walk, so they gave me a cast, and I tried to, you know, maneuver through that, which worked all right. Let's see what else. There were a number of these things, a lot of horses falling down with people on it, people getting broken arms. But, you know, that's the nature of the profession, and we were all kind of prepared for it. We rather liked the adventure of it and the danger of it, you know. It all adds to the making of a movie.
Tony Curtis recorded in 1991. Here's Bill Evans' recording of the love theme from Spartacus. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton released some old tax returns today, as he said he would do last night. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Mara Lyson will have a complete report on the release of the tax information. The president is releasing the returns for the years when he began in Arkansas in public office. Also, Dr. David Kessler of the Food and Drug Administration has raised before Congress the idea that the government could ban nicotine and tobacco. Kessler said that tobacco companies may be controlling the levels of nicotine to create and sustain an addiction. Also, Silvia Pajoli reports on the weekend election in Italy. Both houses of parliament will be selected. And Mike Schuster reports on election Sunday in Ukraine.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Now we have a review of a new film. Whether on TV or directing movies, Ron Howard seems to have been with us practically forever. Now he's directed a newspaper movie from a script by David Koepp, who wrote Jurassic Park and Carlito's Way, and his brother Stephen, who works at Time magazine. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of The Paper.
The problem with Ron Howard is that he makes movies exactly the way Opie or Richie Cunningham would make them. He makes them nice. The classic newspaper comedies of the 30s and 40s, movies like The Front Page, Five Star Final, and the greatest of them all, His Girl Friday, they weren't about nice. They assumed that a newspaper man or woman was a definite, vastly entertaining type, that he or she had emerged fully formed from the head of some ink-stained Zeus, shooting wisecracks, drinking and smoking, and conning everybody in sight to get that scoop. In the paper, the gang at a down-at-the-heels New York tabloid called The Sun tries desperately to conjure up the wisecracks and tough talk and con artistry, but everybody here seems to have come down with kinder, gentler disease. These people have too many feelings. And worse, they have feelings that come not from some sharp-eyed exploration of character, but from other movies. The paper spans 24 hours. And during that time, everybody in it has a big personal crisis and tries to figure out where his true values lie. Michael Keaton, who plays the Metro editor Henry Hackett, has the sappiest, most familiar conflict in the book. That's right, career versus family. His wife, Martha, played by Marissa Tomei, is hugely pregnant, and now she's worried. She used to be a crack reporter herself, but once the baby's born, will she ever get her career back? And will Henry ever be around to help her with the kid? Henry's just gone for a job interview at the stately Uptown paper that's called The Sentinel, but is very obviously the New York Times. The job there would be better paying and less hectic, more 9-to-5, so he could have more time with his wife and kid. But instead of impressing the bow-tied Sentinel editor, Henry steals a scoop off his desk and gets caught, which means he's got a lot of explaining to do when he faces Martha about it.
I couldn't resist. They are so smug over there. They got maps, they've got seating charts of you guys.
No, you did it on purpose.
What are you talking
about?
You
did exactly what I asked you not to do.
You're shouting, first of all.
I know I'm shouting. I like to shout. Okay. Don't you notice when I keep talking louder, it's because you haven't heard. I try to have a sense of humor about things, but all it gets me is a smile and a pat on the head. You don't listen,
Henry. I
don't
listen.
You don't see.
Of course I see. I see what?
How scared I am.
There's too much of that sort of thing in the paper, and not enough of what the movie does best. Not enough of the screaming and yelling and newsroom madness that made the old newspaper movies so invigorating, and that gives this one enough juicy scenes to make it pretty entertaining, despite its flaws. The movie wastes Robert Duvall as the wise old editor, and Randy Quaid as a paranoid columnist, and even Marissa Tomei, who spends too much of the movie sulking and bemoaning her belly. But Glenn Close is terrifically steely as the hard-bitten managing editor, and Michael Keaton is a wonder. He zips through even the fastest-moving scenes, with the grace and aplomb of a cheetah among wolves. They move fast, but he leaves them yipping at his heels and still manages to look languid. The paper isn't a very good movie, but when Keaton is at his best, he can almost make you think it's sublime.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Today's archive program was produced by Danny Miller and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. Our interns are Ann Neville and Devin Reif. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a shave, a haircut, or an amputation. We talk with Dr. Ira Rutko about the days of barber surgeons and the practice of surgery before anesthesia and sterilization. Rutko is a surgeon and the author of Surgery and Illustrated History. I'm Terry Gross, and if you're not squeamish, I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.